This evening, Dr. Thomas Woodward from Trinity College is here. Would you please give him a warm welcome?
Thank you so much, Pastor. I did promise this morning to tell a story related to this cool, groovy, I'm dating myself by some of these words I'm using, this really, really, what would we call it? Preppy. I think it's a preppy tie. Can I use that phrase? It's got stripes and it's got little, you know, lions, you know, little lion logos, like it's from something from the British Empire. Okay, and it's interesting. Can I put it like this? Can you ever see that? I don't know. You can't see it. You can come up later and look at it, okay? And the reason I'm telling the story is that it touched my heart. And it took place in a country that our ministry, called the C.S. Lewis Society, had targeted close to 20 years ago. I had targeted the country of Uruguay. Some people came to me after the morning service and said, what is this C.S. Lewis Society? I mean, is it like a ministry? Yes, it's a ministry. We minister to atheists and agnostics or skeptics. You can just kind of give the umbrella term, who have intellectual problems or, you know, reasons for not believing in the Bible or in Christ or in creation. We try to honestly deal with those questions and set forth the arguments, the evidences. Sometimes we use logical forms. Sometimes we just talk about the scientific evidence. I give talks all the time on that. And one of the things we do is we equip Christians. Okay, so when I went to Uruguay, some of my time was spent in churches in Montevideo, the capital. I'm fluent in Spanish. My wife and I were missionaries from 86 to 88 in the Dominican Republic. Anybody here from the Dominican Republic? Okay, no one here from the Dominican Republic that I can see. Santo Domingo. And so I got to be quite fluent in Spanish. I give my lectures. I have my PowerPoints also in Spanish, so I can minister in Spanish as well. And so I was invited to go down to minister in the churches, but to skeptical groups. I mean, there was one town of Florida, like the state Florida, where all the churches came together, rented an auditorium, and they packed the place out. And half of them were non-Christian, what they call in Uruguay, Catholic atheists. Yes, culturally Catholic, but functionally atheist. And because that country is unique in its secularism. So I had kind of targeted, because it was, number one, Spanish speaking. You know, I can present my talks in Spanish. Number two, lots of agnostics. It's really strange. It's a unique country. All the other Catholic, predominantly Catholic countries of Latin America, the atheist percentage is 2 or 3%. Uruguay, it jumps to 45%. So I had targeted the country. And so the first two places were the British School of Uruguay, which is the number one school. And I spoke to the upper division. I think I spoke to mainly juniors and seniors. They filled a small auditorium. And then the faculty, the entire science faculty at least, was there, sitting on the back row, kind of like, what's he going to say? Okay. Because they knew it was Darwin versus design. So actually I spoke in English. It was kind of nice. I was able to give my lecture in English. And the headmaster ahead of time said, I understand you attended Princeton University. Would you talk to the seniors at 4 o'clock today about getting into American colleges? Sure, I say. I said I'd be glad to. Okay, thank you. So I presented my standard PowerPoint, which includes some of the slides I used earlier in this morning and some of the slides I'll use later in this evening's talk. And I really was passionate. I mean, I really put my all into it. And he came up and he led them in a nice round of applause, and he said, students, you've seen a marvelous example of a university-level lecture, and this is just outstanding presentation. And so they applauded me, and he told the students that they would come back that evening, or at 4 o'clock when the school day was over. So I came back at 4, went to the library, and there were about 15 seniors there, and the biology teacher. Okay, and then I said, okay, who wants to talk about, what do you want to ask about getting into colleges and universities in the U.S.? Not a single hand was raised. Did you come here to talk about another thing? And they all said, yes, we came to talk about the problems of Darwinism. One senior said, we've never heard anything about this, so we want to hear more information. We've never heard about the problems with Darwinism. And I said, and then Rosina Macatelli, the biology teacher, sitting right next to me, and she said, yeah, they came to me at lunch and said, could we hear more? And she says, I want to hear more. And I said, well, buckle your seatbelts, lecture number two. And so I launched into, from my extensive study of the origin of life, problem, how chemicals could just kind of, sitting in a pond somewhere, just kind of begin to hold hands, you know, amino acids holding hands with other amino acids, forming protein, which formed in another protein, and then more proteins came together, and DNA came together, and RNA. That scenario is riddled with holes. Every year it's studied, we find more problems. It has become what they thought was a molehill has become a mountain of a problem. And it's just a very, very powerful area. I mean, it's one of the most important areas of evidence. So I was just throwing out and talking about the problem of protein generation, the problem of specific chirality, which is left-handedness and amino acid. And then all of a sudden, this one senior raises his hand and says, "Do you mean to say you believe that God made life?" I mean, he got it. Okay. And I said, "Yeah, of course. And I believe that there are good biblical reasons, you know, that I can, you know, point to the God of the Bible as the one who created life. But that's more of a side issue that deals with other kinds of historical evidence. Let's finish the talk, and then we can come back there if you want." And so then I ran back into my series of points I wanted to make and got through. And they left me, everyone left me their email. I went continuing to send them information. The headmaster told me that it was a breaking out of this issue across the campus that endured for 2.5 months. The rest of the semester, everybody was debating and doing, you know, internet research. I mean, it's incredible. The lady, Micah Telly, came to my house and handed her a copy of Michael Behe's book in Spanish. The Darwin's Black Box book had just come out in Spanish. And what was interesting to me is that, you know, the guy who had set up these talks, he was a missionary from, I think, New Zealand to Uruguay. He was a born-again Christian missionary. And his wife worked there at this British school, Uruguay. They gave me the tie. That, by the way, that's a connection. That was their thank you for coming. I said, "What's the tie got to do with it?" Okay, that was the token that they gave me. So the guy driving me back to my house, I stayed with another missionary. He says, "You will not ever understand how powerful it was when that one senior raised his hand and asked you if you thought God had created it." I said, "Why is that?" He said, "We know everybody in that room. My wife knows all those families. And everyone in that room, you know, was probably baptized in the Roman Catholic Church, but has no belief in a God or creator at all." And he said, at that moment, when that senior asked that question, it was like a paradigm shift, because that student and the other students realized they were looking at a person who was well-informed, you know, clear-headed, sane, in command of the facts, and did not believe in the theory of macroevolution or chemical evolution at all. And that became a real possibility for them, at least a hypothetical possibility for them to believe in that too. And then as I told the story back in our office to one of the office managers, Jason Anderson, he was one of my students up at Trinity College, or down at Trinity College, I should say, in Florida. Jason said, "Prof, they didn't want to know how to get into Princeton. They wanted to know how to get into heaven." I thought, that's a moment where God brought out the truth. And so that's kind of like one of those like moments where God, as it were, parted the sky, you know, the clouds in the sky, and I saw the potential for intelligent design building a bridge to non-Christians, and as well as firing up Christians who are kind of maybe a little bit lackadaisical and lacking that excitement that they should have. Now, we talked earlier today about protons and neutrons, okay? I brought my proton and neutron back, and I forgot to show you my electron. I'm pretty proud of my electron. Have you ever remember Super Bowl? Remember some of you grew up in the 50s and 60s? You throw a Super Bowl and it flies over a building. It recovers 90% of its bounce. Here, let me throw the. Can somebody down there catch that? Woo! Okay, good job. Woo! She caught the electron. Now, obviously, I use a super ball as an electron because electrons whiz around the outside. All three. I'll get that later. You can hold on to that's your token. Okay. The thing about fine tuning. We talked about fine tuning. Remember that, those of you here this morning. And what is fine tuning? It means that there are more and more factors, constants, quantities, like the rate of the expansion of the universe. The forces of nature, I talked about that you had to have a balance. For even stars to burn, you have to have a balance between the gravitational force constant and what's called the electromagnetic force constant, which is the cause of electricity. Those two constants have to be balanced to 40 decimal places. I'd say that's pretty fine-tuning. I mean, I don't even know of a car that requires, or a machine that requires precision of 40 decimal places. Well, they've found that the weights of the proton or mass and the mass of a neutron and the mass of the electron, which is just a tiny bit compared to proton and neutron, even the mass has to be fine-tuned. Everything in nature seems to be fine-tuned, and that's what the Privileged Planet video is all about. And then when you get up from the level of just the little, you know, protons and neutrons to whole long molecules, remember this? Does anybody remember what this is? Protein. This is a protein molecule, and each of these little colored balls represents amino acid. Very good. Give her an A+. All right. Amino acids. And a typical protein has how many amino acids? Let me answer that. Short, 40. Typical short, I mean, that's the shortest. A typical short protein, 100 amino acids. I think this is about 50. My wife made one that is about 250. It stretches about 30 feet out there, maybe not quite 30, about 10 or 15. And it's pretty cool. A longer protein would stretch, with this many amino acids, would stretch from here down to the front of the church. It would be about 100 feet long or maybe longer if it was a model this size. Isn't that incredible? And each one of these units has to be, if you will, fine-tuned in the sense being in the correct order. Because a protein is like a long piece of spaghetti that is produced in the cell. And once the spaghetti is spun out of the spaghetti machine, it isn't just a kind of a lame, kind of loosey-goosey piece of spaghetti. It immediately starts folding into a three-dimensional shape. Now, when I first started teaching this at Trinity, I made some very interesting sound effects. And I would pretend to be the protein chain, and I'd go, whoop. And my students laughed at me so much, I stopped using my protein sound effects. So you've gotten to hear a very unusual, you know, bringing back of an old performance, which I think that's enough of silliness now. But these proteins are amazing because unless, for example, I have a yellow, a blue, an orange, and a kind of a pale yellow, pale green, I guess that is. There's a kind of a Kelly green over here. Unless those five specific amino acids, because at each position, they're like letters in an alphabet. It's like an A and a B and an L and an X and a Y. Unless you have exactly the right order, once the protein is assembled, if the order is not right, it will not begin folding into its precise, exact three-dimensional shape. The shape, the final shape, as the protein folding begins in the kind of the funny rapid sequence folding, which is they're still figuring out exactly how this is done, you will not get the precise shape. So, for example, when we talked about the flagellum, the outboard motor, and some of the proteins form what's called the universal joint. It's literally a tube that looks like a universal joint and it functions like that. Unless you have the precise order of the letters, protein letters, which are called amino acids, it'll just lie there and fall apart. The cell will destroy it. And so at the root of biology is not just fine-tuning, it's information. Information is the great discovery. And information only comes from intelligence. We have never seen information, especially sequences of letters, coming from just raw processes of nature. I thought of another word besides stupid evolution. Okay? I mean, I like that idea, but we have intelligent design versus unintelligent nature. Think of that, unintelligent nature. Now, unintelligent nature is obedient nature, it's law-like nature, but it can only do what it's pre-programmed to do. And the Creator has created this wonderful precision, you know, the neutron, the proton, the electron, and all the forces that make them work together. These forces are very predictable. You can describe them on a sheet of paper with a little mathematical formulas, but they're very predictable. You could never have a predictable force produce an unpredictable sequence of letters. Letters imply intelligence. And that, at the root, in a sense, is the heart of the argument for intelligent design. Now let's go ahead and jump in to a discussion of Behe. We'll show you a clip of Behe, and then we'll talk about fossils. Does that sound good? So Michael Behe and irreducible complexity, and then we'll jump into a fossil discussion, and we'll call it a night. We'll hold off on the video clip. We'll just go with my slides here. There's Michael Behe, and this is point three. We're kind of building on what we talked about this morning. And that's the evidence from Dr. Behe. Of course, he lives in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. He's become world famous. So Pennsylvania has been put on the map, not only for Dover, which we'll talk about that later, but it's been put on the map because of what happened at Lehigh University when Dr. Behe produced his book, Darwin's Black Box. He's a professor of biology, I said, at Lehigh University, and his Darwin's Black Box has been a huge success. I mean, it's been printed at the rate of, I think, 6,000 to 10,000 books a year, which on the being 9 years out, it's pretty amazing. And there's actually going to be a 10th anniversary edition that comes out this summer. And Mike told me that he's adding another chapter. I think it's chapter 11 or 12. And he basically declares victory. Okay? In other words, he says, this is what all the critics have had to say. And he's going to point out why the criticisms he's gotten have only confirmed his thesis, have only confirmed his hypothesis. Now, let me just point out that his critique has been discussed in the New York Times on 5 different occasions. 3 of those occasions, the Times invited him to provide an op-ed account, or you might say a column, explaining his thesis. It's been very powerful. Now, this is a picture of his book as it originally appeared in the hardback edition, and the box, the idea of a black box, it's like my computer. I can tell you, since I bought this in Cambridge, England this summer, I can tell you how to push on this button and get that result, how to push on this button to get my PowerPoint to come up. But to me, I don't know how the innards work. You see, to me, this is a black box. I do not know how internally it works. And the cell, to Darwin, was a black box. He had no idea how complex it would be. As a matter of fact, Ernst Haeckel, some of you remember the guy that fudged the drawings of embryos? Remember that if you were here this morning? Ernst Haeckel was fond of calling the cell or describing it as a little glob of protoplasm, a little glob of jello, okay? Something simple. You know, I ought to have a little bowl of jello here to jiggle in front of you. That's just simple. I mean, it's just the same all the way through. As far as they knew, that's the way a cell was. And then the 20th century began to reveal more and more, and by 1953, when I was 3 years old, they figured out the structure of DNA and proteins, and they realized the complex informational nature of those molecules. Now, once you open this black box in the 50s and the 60s, and especially it's accelerating when you get into the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and now in the year beyond the year 2000, they're figuring out the nuts and bolts. They're figuring out the individual pieces of these machines. And what they found was not simplicity, but horrendous, endless complexity. Layers of complexity built upon smaller complexity. You see, nanomachines with so many working parts, the scientists literally shook their heads and said, I can't believe this is so complex. And I mentioned blood clotting. Well, we'll get to that in a minute. Okay. It's based on a quote from Darwin's own theory. I call it Darwin's breakdown quote. It's on about halfway through the book. It's in his chapter 6, which is called Problems with My Theory. And it's a chapter that grew longer and longer and longer as he went through 6 editions before he died in 1882, I think it was. And this is the statement of Darwin's theory. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed, which could not possibly have been formed by numerous, successive, slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Isn't that great? Now, I think we need to praise God for Darwin's willingness to put his theory up to a test. Notice what he says. If you can find something in an organ, like some organic part, you know, an organism, you can't come up with a plausible story of how it was built step by tiny step, you know, how it was gradually developed, my theory falls apart. And what Behe does, he says, thank you, Charles Darwin. I'll take your test and I'll apply it to this nanomachine world of the molecular complexity, and I'll show how many such machines or systems, complex systems, we're finding inside the cell, which appear to rule out any kind of step-by-step Darwinian explanation. And it's been rather fascinating. He says, Behe does, that Darwinism breaks down when scientists find structures that have a complexity of interacting parts like a machine which doesn't work even if one part is removed. In other words, if you have a certain minimal complexity, you get down to the bare minimum. Well, tires, I need that for car. Now, maybe my horn, I can do away without the horn. You know, it'd be nice to have. But I need 4 tires, okay? And I need certain parts. If you get down to the minimum car, you just have to have these parts. And how could you have a car without those parts of that function? That's sort of the idea. Behe coined a phrase for this machine-like complexity. He called it irreducible complexity. And by irreducible, he means it can't be reduced any further and have a function. And what does this mean? And he uses something simple like a mousetrap. And we'll see this in the video. The mousetrap requires 5 parts. The hammer, which is the U-shaped part, the little bent piece of metal, which does the squishing of the mouse. Sorry about the violent language. okay? It has the base, you know, which kind of holds the thing together. It has the holding bar, which holds the hammer back. It has the spring, which gives the impulse power. It has the catch, the sensitive trigger. Okay, and he says, you can't put out a base and hope to catch some mice, you know, as they trip on the base and fall over and die, okay? And then add a spring and catch a few more mice and add the, you know, the hammer, etc. You have to have all five parts or you don't catch any mice. And so the mouse trap, therefore, is irreducibly complex. And this has become a symbol. It's such a symbol. People, as he goes to speak in front of a large audience, they hand him a golden mouse trap or something. Okay, it's kind of a symbol of his theory. But this has been, and of course, in my new book, Darwin Strikes Back, I'm dealing with how they've tried to just slug and just pound his analogy of the mouse trap with their sledgehammers and beat it up. And I think this is so funny because it's just an analogy. After all, it's just an analogy. I think it still works. I think all of their attacks on the analogy have failed utterly. But it's just funny that they're doing their best to kind of, we think that the mousetrap analogy fails utterly. And therefore, Behe's theory collapses. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, it's just an analogy. It's a teaching tool. I mean, oh well, I'm getting worked up. Okay. Then he goes from that to a really humorous example. This is... Oh, what's the name of the guy, the cartoonist? Rube Goldberg. I have a senior moment here. Okay, a Rube Goldberg contraption. This is called the mosquito biting. And I think I can, you see my little cursor? I got my cursor working now. I feel so good. Okay, here's where the Rube Goldberg thing, you know, the water comes down the gathering, you know, water pipe, the drain pipe A. It collects in this little beaker B. There's floating down here a cork C. And as the water rises, so does this little needle attached to the cork. The needle eventually comes up and punctures this paper cup F, which is filled with beer. The beer dribbles down on top of this bird, which imbibes some of it and gets drunk. The bird stumbles and falls off onto this platform H, a spring platform, which propels it back up to the second platform I. The bird then pulls on this in its drunken state. It thinks this is a worm, so it pulls on this thread, firing cannon K down here, scaring dog L. Okay, dog L flips over in his fear and fright and rapid breathing, raises and lowers metal piece N connected to needle P, scratching the mosquito bite O, causing no embarrassment to the gentleman while he converses with the lady. You like that? Now that's the mosquito bite scratcher. A Rube Goldberg contraption, truly, okay? And so now you say, well, the young people are saying, who's Rube Goldberg, you know? See, now you've discovered a whole new world of humor. I mean, I think he must have published, you know, I don't know, 50 or 100, maybe 200 of these contraptions. They're very funny. And the reason he uses this is that blood clotting is a little bit like that. Blood clotting has 20 protein parts that have to trigger one another in a quick, precise sequence. And the first one detects the oxygen, which goes over and activates the second, which moves over and triggers the third, which then pulls off a sticky end of the fourth, which unites with the fifth, and they go over and activate the sixth, which triggers the seventh, which goes to the eighth, ninth, tenth, 11th, 12th, the 20th is the fiber net, which is the mesh that sets up the clot. And I've had many people who went to med school, I've had nurses come up to me and they said, I'm so excited. We studied the 20 protein blood clotting cascade, or the blood clot cascade. It's a cascade of 20 proteins that have to trigger one another in quick sequence. And then Behe wrote a whole chapter in his book on the blood clot sequence. It's called Rube Goldberg in the Blood. Okay, and that's the idea. Now, I think we can see that there's something very interesting going on because the whole cell, from one end to the other, not just in this DNA compartment, the nucleus, but all around the cell, there are all kinds of complex machines. He's put it this way. He said the cell is chock full of complex, irreducibly complex machines that have been discovered in the last few decades. And then he says, even the amazing flagellum, which we talked about earlier, this rotary outboard motor that has 40 different protein parts. It has a drive shaft. It has bushings, and we're going to see it operate in just a second from the unlocking video. That is almost the supreme example. Behe's shocking discovery is that the number of published proposals over the past 40 years showing how these irreducibly complex systems might have evolved, the number of published examples or proposals is a nice round number, zero. there are zero published proposals from the evolutionary biology literature explaining any testable scenario, how these might have evolved. In other words, not just Behe, you know, has no knowledge. He's not the only one who has no idea how they evolved. No biologist anywhere has any idea how they might have evolved. And where he finds a thundering silence, he raises the heretical question. Why not consider the possibility of the intelligent design of these systems? Remember the movie Contact? Some of you may have seen Ellie Haraway, played by Jodie Foster, the atheist astronomer. And in this movie, it's a very, very good science fiction film. And in the movie, she says, I don't believe in God, basically. And yet she's receiving messages from outer space. And these messages indicate an intelligence. They actually send instructions about building this kind of special, you know, machine to propel her. I don't want to steal the thunder from the plot if you haven't seen the movie, but to propel her across the universe to meet the aliens. Very interesting movie. And if messages, supposedly, you know, some coded message, some I Love Lucy program coming in from Andromeda, okay, were to be received, we wouldn't say, oh, science has died. We've detected intelligence. No. It would be considered the greatest triumph of science. And yet, notice, to apply a filter to electromagnetic static or data, radio data coming in from outer space, and to look for intelligent coded messages, and then assigned, if we see a code, we say, ah, intelligence produced it. That shows that science can deal with the idea of detecting intelligence. Do you follow me? Science in this SETI program, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, science already, without, you know, batting an eyelash, says, yeah, we can detect intelligence. And so we, the ID movement, said, we agree. There are filters, there are tests whereby you can determine positively if an intelligence is involved. So why do you say, do that with outer space, but don't go near the cell? You know, stay away from the cell. Don't apply your filter to the cell, just outer space. We say, no, why not apply it to the flagellum or the blood clotting sequence or proteins? That a typical protein has quite often 500 to 1,000 letters precisely arranged. And we know from testing exactly which letters are absolutely critical and which you can fudge a little bit. You can do tests now. We know how unintelligent nature is, and we know from our testing that unintelligent nature seems to utterly lack the ability to assemble even one gene. Let me tell you, I wasn't going to even share this, but I heard a professor, you might want to write this down. This guy is the next Behe, in my opinion. You want to hear a kind of a, you know, Newsweek magazine used to have Washington, or U.S. News and World Report used to have Washington Whispers. Remember that? You know, things that were coming up. And this guy is going to be, wow. His name is Ralph Seelke, S-E-E-L-K-E. He's at the University of Wisconsin Superior. He's tested a trillion bacteria through 1,000 generations over the last 15 years. And he's taken proteins like this in a multi-protein system, and he's carefully knocked out one, two, or three proteins. His prediction was one amino acid, one of these little digits, they could repair through mutation. Two, he predicted wouldn't happen in his lab, but it might happen at some point in the universe. Three, he predicted would never happen. And his research has 100% confirmed that. Protein defecting or, you know, mutating to remove one within a year or less than a year. Typically, a bacteria will repair it through a mutation. So one mutation leap can be made. Two mutations, he hasn't found a chance yet, or an example. Three mutations he thinks will never happen in the entire history of the universe. How many mutations does it take to develop a new protein? Dozens. Hundreds in some cases. And if you can't get to beyond the wall of three mutations, how could you develop a single gene? In the end of my book, I make a very strong assertion. Darwinian evolution will be gone within 20 years because it cannot predict and it cannot give experimental evidence for the production ever in the 150 years of its existence of one gene, one single sequence of DNA coding for one protein having to come in existence. It could implode within 10 years, but I think 20 years is outside. I've asked four members, leading members of the ID movement, do you agree? He says, oh, yeah, it's sure to happen within 20 years, maybe within 10. And there are new ideas that are being put out there because quietly the Darwinians are evacuating their theory. I mean, at night when you're not looking,
They're coming up. They're building new ships, you know. They're building new escape platforms. Well, we have this idea called Origination of Organismal Form. 20 people at MIT have met, and we have a book out. And yet, in the book, they basically swear off Darwinism. They said it's never helped us. It never has, never will. We're developing a new theory. Our best people are working on it. Okay? Trust us. So I think that ID will come up, and this new, I call it OOF, the Origination of Organismal Form, will come up, and the two will duke it out for years. And I think Darwinism will be gone within 10 to 20 years. Well, in conclusion, Darwin's ship is sinking. It has major leaks. Darwinism's failure flows not from religious objections, but from empirical evidence. And there's only one conclusion that seems fit with the evidence. The super intellect crafted the complexity and diversity of the life that we see around us. Now, we're going to shift and show a little bit of that Michael Behe sequence. And if you could turn off the slides, I'll do the switch to the other as well. Thank you.
Natural selection acts only by taking advantage of slight successive variations. She can never take a great and sudden leap, but must advance by short and sure, though slow steps.
It's really interesting to notice that the more we know about life and the more we know about biology, the more problems Darwinism has and the more design becomes apparent.
Since 1988, Dr. Michael Behe has investigated complex biological systems that seem to defy explanation by natural selection.
For the longest time, I believed that Darwinian evolution explains what we saw in biology, not because I saw how it could actually explain it, but because I was told that it did explain it. In schools, I was taught Darwinian biology. And through college and graduate school, I was in an atmosphere which just assumed that Darwinian evolution explained biology. And again, I didn't have any reason to doubt it. It wasn't until about 10 years or more ago that I read a book called Evolution, a Theory in Crisis by a geneticist by the name of Michael Denton, an Australian, and he put forward a lot of scientific arguments against Darwinian theory that I had never heard before, and the arguments seemed pretty convincing. And at that point, I started to get a bit angry because I thought I was being led down the primrose path. Here were a number of very good arguments, and I had gone through a doctoral program in biochemistry, became a faculty member, and I had never even heard of these things. And so from that point on, I became very interested in the question of evolution, and since have decided the Darwinian processes are not the whole explanation for life.
Michael Behe's skepticism derived in large measure from what modern biology has revealed about life's most fundamental unit, the cell.
In the 19th century, when Darwin was alive, scientists thought that the basis of life, the cell, was some simple glob of protoplasm, like a little piece of jello or something that was not hard to explain at all.
This perception didn't really change too much until the early 1950s. But in the last half century, our knowledge of the cell has just exploded.
Today, powerful technologies reveal elaborate microscopic worlds. Worlds so small that a thimbleful of cultured liquid can contain more than 4 billion single-cell bacteria, each packed with circuits, assembly instructions, and miniature machines, the complexity of which Charles Darwin could never have imagined.
At the very basis of life, where molecules and cells run the show, we've discovered machines, literally molecular machines. There are little molecular trucks that carry supplies from one end of the cell to the other. There are machines which capture the energy from sunlight and turn it into usable energy.
There are as many molecular machines in the human body as there are functions that the body has to do. So if you think about hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, feeling, blood clotting, respiratory action, the immune response, all of those require a host of machines.
When we look at these machines, we ask ourselves, where do they come from? And the standard answer, Darwinian evolution, is very inadequate in my view.
In speaking on the topic of scientific naturalism and evolution...
During the early 1990s, at a series of academic conferences, Behe first shared his doubts about the ability of natural selection to construct complex molecular machines. One machine particularly attracted his attention.
I remember the first time I looked in a biochemistry textbook and I saw a drawing of something called a bacterial flagellum with all of its parts in all of its glory. It had a propeller and the hook region and the drive shaft and the motor and so on. I looked at that and I said, that's an outboard motor. That's designed. You know, that's no chance assemblage of parts.
Behe's reaction was not surprising. For the molecular motors that drive bacteria through liquid, each depend upon a system of intricately arranged mechanical parts. These parts come into focus when portions of a cell are magnified 50,000 times. Biochemists have used electron micrographs like this one to identify the parts and three-dimensional structure of the flagellar motor. In the process, they have revealed a marvel of engineering on a miniaturized scale.
Howard Berg at Harvard has labeled it the most efficient machine in the universe. These machines, some of them are running at 100,000 RPMs and are hardwired into a signal transduction or sensory mechanism so that it's getting feedback from the environment.
And even though they're spinning that fast, they can stop on a dime. It only takes a quarter turn for them to stop and shift directions and start spinning 100,000 RPM in the other direction.
And just like outboard motors on motorboats, it has a large number of parts which are necessary for the motor to work.
The bacterial flagellum, two gears, forward and reverse, water-cooled, proton motive force, it has a stator, it has a rotor, it has a U-joint, it has a drive shaft, it has a propeller, and they function as these parts of machines. It's not convenient that we give them these names. That's truly their function.
Since its discovery, scientists have tried to understand how a rotary motor could have arisen through natural selection. As yet, they have failed to offer any detailed Darwinian explanation. To see why, we must understand a feature of molecular machines known as irreducible complexity.
Irreducible complexity was coined by Mike Behe in describing these molecular machines. Basically, what it says is that you have multi-component parts to any given organelle or system in a cell, all of which are necessary for function. That is, if you remove one part, you lose function of that system.
The idea of irreducible complexity can be illustrated by a familiar non-biological machine, a mouse trap. The trap is composed of five basic pieces: a catch to hold the bait, a strong spring, a thin bent rod called the hammer, a holding bar to secure the hammer in place, and a platform upon which the entire system is mounted. If any one of these parts is missing or defective, the mechanism will not work. All components of this irreducibly complex system must be present simultaneously for the machine to perform its function, catching mice. Irreducible complexity also applies to biological machines, including the bacterial flagellar motor.
All told, there are about 40 different protein parts which are necessary for this machine to work. And if any of those parts are missing, then either you get a flagellum that doesn't work because it's missing the hook or it's missing the drive shaft or whatever, or it doesn't even get built within the cell.
In evolutionary terms, you have to be able to explain how you can build this system gradually when there's no function until you have all those parts in place.
The irreducible complexity of molecular machines poses a severe challenge to the power of natural selection. According to Darwin's theory, even very complex biological structures like an eye, an ear, or a heart can be built gradually over time in small incremental steps. Yet, as Darwin made clear, natural selection can only succeed if these random genetic changes provide some advantage to the evolving organism in its struggle for survival.
As I have attempted to show, it is not necessary to suppose that the modifications were all simultaneous if they were extremely slight and gradual. Natural selection is scrutinizing the slightest variations, rejecting those that are bad, preserving and adding up all that are good.
But could Darwin's small, favorable variations have produced a bacterial flagellum? Some scientists doubt the possibility.
How could something new, like a bacteriophlagellar motor and all the components that go with it, how could it develop out of a population of bacteria that don't have that system? When each change, according to Darwin's theory, has to provide some kind of advantage.
Imagine such a scenario early in the Earth's history. An evolving bacterium somehow develops a tail and perhaps even the pieces necessary to attach it to the cell wall. Yet without a complete motor assembly, this innovation would provide no advantage to the cell. Instead, the tail would lie immobile and useless, invisible to natural selection, which by definition can only favor changes that aid survival.
The logic of natural selection is very demanding. Unless the flagellum mechanism is completely assembled and actually works, natural selection simply cannot preserve it. It cannot be passed on to the next generation.
The important thing to realize about natural selection is it selects only for a functional advantage. In most cases, natural selection actually eliminates things that have no function or that have a function that harms the organism. So if you had a bacterium with a tail that didn't function as a flagellum, chances are natural selection would eliminate it. The only way you can select for a flagellum is if you have a flagellum that works, and that means you have to have all the pieces of the motor in place to begin with. So natural selection can't get you the bacterial flagellum. It can only work after the flagellum is there and operating.
In 1996, Michael Behe published a book titled Darwin's Black Box. In it, he argued that natural selection, Darwin's designer substitute, could not explain the origin of the bacterial flagellum or any other irreducibly complex biological system. Instead, Behe concluded that the integrated complexity of these systems pointed to intelligent design. Darwin's black box created immediate controversy. Over 75 publications, including some of the world's leading newspapers and scientific journals, reviewed the book. Some scientists praised Behe's work, while others dismissed it as unscientific and religiously motivated. Behe's critics also insisted that he had underestimated the power of natural selection. They argued that the flagellar motor could have been constructed from parts used to build simpler molecular machines, like this needle-nose cellular pump. If the components of the pump already existed, they could have been preserved by natural selection even before the bacterial motor arose. This theory is called co-option.
It's essentially saying that evolution or natural selection at some point was able to borrow components of one molecular machine and build a new machine with some of these components.
Scott Minnick has studied the flagellar motor for nearly 20 years. His research has led him to challenge the co-option argument.
Okay, I think we'll stop the tape right there.
Bacterial flagellum.
Thank you very much.
Hope you enjoy the quality of that video. Yeah, I think it's a terrific tool. And like I said, we said earlier, if you'd like to get a copy, we will try to speed that to your home just using the little forms that are available at the left-hand side of the main entrance as you leave. The next thing, I want to leap, as it were, from the micro to the macro. In other words, from the tiny, the super tiny, that you almost barely can't even see with electron microscope, to the big things, the animals that we can see by looking just there at pieces of rock. We call these the fossils, the fossil evidence, imprints left over by usually by the hard parts, the bone, the teeth, the shells, and sometimes by even the soft parts. If you have the right kind of sediment, you could even preserve jellyfish, you know, or even down to the little level of embryos of sponges they've found, and even bacteria. Can you imagine that? They've actually caught bacteria, as it were, splitting into two in some of the very fine grain examination of rocks. So let's go ahead and put the slide up. This is I'm kind of, as it were, going in reverse order. I'm going to the beginning of this whole talk: fossils that embarrass Darwin. Is Darwin's ship sinking? Let me bring in the ship of Darwin. Okay. That's like the Nina Pinta Santa Maria ship. So it's a little bit out of, maybe that's more like 1500s instead of the 1830s when he went on his voyage to the Galapagos Islands. But it'll do. Now, this ship is going to represent the paradigm. Okay, I think I actually may have I don't have the word paradigm there. But that ship represents the paradigm, or the big system of thought that Darwin developed and which dominates the scientific world, or at least biology today. As we look at the such beautiful pictures as the Andromeda Galaxy, this is the nearest large spiral galaxy. It's supposedly, I'm told, 2 million light years away. And it's a beautiful representation of what probably our own Milky Way galaxy looks like if you go away from it and look back on it. I've often been tempted to put a little X, like in mall, you know, one of those mall maps, you know, you are here, so you can know where you are in the Milky Way. But the beauty of creation even extends out to the evidence that we're getting now from the most distant galaxies. This is taken from the center portion of what's called the Hubble Deep Field Telescope. Each of those blobs or galaxies is estimated to be 10, at least 8 to 10 billion light years away. None of them could be seen by a land-based telescope. The Hubble telescope caught these images. Now, the beauty of the creation out in the far distance is kind of like, you might say, just intuitive evidence for design. But to me, the most important evidence really is found in biology. And so the question I would raise for us, are biologists open to design? Well, in a way, yes. They see design everywhere, but they say nature did the designing. There's design, all right, but it's just natural. It's an illusion of natural selection, you see, crafting design over a long period of time. So, nature did the designing. And their creator substitute is the gradual mutation selection process. Mutation, DNA typographical error. Selection, nature selects the better. Now, I believe in the ability of natural selection to weed out the genetically unfit. You know, if there's a three-legged coyote or a one-legged rabbit or something, the poor thing, you know, the mutant probably won't survive. You know, it probably will not be able to gather food and, you know, go on to the next, reproduce the next generation. So you might say natural selection is a no-brainer. Actually, I haven't hardly ever said this, but Edward Blyth, a British biologist in the 1830s, discovered natural selection even before Darwin published it, and he was a creationist. Okay, and he saw it as God's built-in handiwork way of maintaining the quality, you might say, the genetic quality of animals. We know we don't do that in humans. There's no hint in Scripture that we ever should, you know, as it were, you know, put down anyone's mutant. God says just the opposite: preserve humanity. They are created in His image. So, but this creation natural selection process, instead of just maintaining genetic quality, they say is driving to new levels of complexity. And so they don't allow leaps. The prediction then would be continual chains of transitional creatures. If this natural selection process is working very slowly, sculpting new animals, nature should have left the imprints in the fossil rock. Right? Right. Now, let's just see if we find this, in a word, this is continuity. Let's see if we find this continuity.
We already talked this morning about the peppered moth, the right-hand moth, which you know cannot see too well. It's kind of camouflaged on the right side. Over here is the head, the left tip, the right tip, the back of the wing. I don't know if you can see my cursor. The head again is facing this way. And this peppered moth example, it shows, if anything, it shows micro evolution, minor scale, small scale changes as the, you know, the dark or the light can survive against the background color of the tree trunks. Now, if you were here this morning, what's the new problem with these peppered moths is they never rest on tree trunks. Huge problem. You know, when you think of it, the whole story depends on the background, you know, color of the tree trunk compared to the color of their wings, and that gives them survivability. And when the scientific press finally revealed the secret that they had known for 25 years, it was very embarrassing. It was time for backpedaling and much bemoaning of, well, one scientist said, I feel like I've lost my best friend. You know, and so it's really kind of funny. That's the, again, the left tip, the right tip, and the front tip of the head of the moth, and that's really a sad day that they can't use that as their magnificent. Well, it never demonstrated macroevolution. It's just a kind of a trivial microevolution story to begin with. Darwinism's crisis, I reviewed this morning, has the original big bombshell, Michael Denton, Evolution of Theory and Crisis. That's 1885-86. Then Philip Johnson drops his bombshell in 1991, Darwin on trial. Johnson is a law professor, so he's coming at it from an analyst of arguments. He's saying the evidence is built on a shoddy foundation of philosophy. And then we come to the third big bombshell, Michael Behe, Darwin's Black Box. And then we have this final bombshell, Jonathan Wells. Actually, his work came out around the year 2000 and really has been gathering steam since. And then we have the whole work of Bill Dembski that I mentioned. So those are the kind of the big stars of intelligent design, the superstars, if you will. Michael Denton technically is not part of the movement because he has said that he believes that nature can do all this. He just is sure that Darwin's theory has crashed and burnt. But he's looking for a new natural theory. Okay, so he helped to birth the ID movement, but he would be like an onlooker. He's like an interested onlooker more than a part of the movement. The other four you hear there, see there, and about another 30 or 40 other people, including Silke at University of Wisconsin, are in the movement. Now, what is Darwin's real foundation? It's not evidence. Evolution should be built on evidence, but let's see what it really is. The evidence that you hoped, or evolutionists would hope, yields as you scrape away the dirt of the foundation, it's built on the philosophy of naturalism. And I think I should point this out, that if you rule out God to begin with, if your theory begins by saying, well, we know one thing, God didn't do it, then you've got a problematic theory. Because you've ruled out some possibilities before the evidence is even presented. And there's so many people that will present evidence. They'll maybe show the unlocking video, and I want to encourage you to show these videos to atheists or agnostics or evolutionists that you may know. But you may hit a brick wall. The brick wall, the Holy Spirit will penetrate that brick wall as you pray and as you love and as you carefully work with these people. But there is a brick wall, and it's their mindset. It's a philosophy which assumes that any kind of creation is equivalent to magic or superstition. See, it's like an assumption that has grown over years. It's like a deeply rooted oak, and only the Holy Spirit can, as it were, yank that oak out as they see the evidence, as Romans 1:20 begins to get activated in their life, the evidence of the Creator. So it's not an easy job, and I'm just going to show real quickly a couple of the transitional fossils that are missing, and if we can get to them, some of the problem fossils. The transitional fossil mystery is very famous, and I want to summarize it in about 7 or 8 minutes. There are two great facts. We mentioned, I think, in one of the services we got to this slide. There are two great facts. If you learn these facts, time to take a note, okay, if you have some note paper. If you learn these facts, you will know more than 98% of the people in the United States about fossils, about the two most important generalities or facts about the fossil evidence. Are you ready? Okay. These are the two great facts, and this comes from Stephen Jay Gould, G-O-U-L-D, of Harvard University. The first fact is that new types of animals appear abruptly, and this is called abrupt appearance. Okay, I like that name. I can remember that.
Now, you can also put parentheses sudden. Sometimes it's printed as sudden appearance, okay, which is the same thing. In other words, new kinds of animals don't phase in gradually, you know, transitioning gradually. They burst onto the scene. I had a professor at Princeton, a very famous evolutionist. I discussed with him the fossil record, and he said, well, you know what is amazing? These animals seem to come in bursts. That's the word he used. And I said, well, how did they evolve? Well, we haven't found their transitionals yet, but we will find them. You know, faith, great faith, okay? New types appear abruptly, and that's called abrupt appearance. Once those types of animals, whether it be a jellyfish, a zebra, a goat, a mushroom, a palm tree, once those animals are there, unfortunately, the new types stay the same, and this is called stasis. Stasis, S-T-A-S-I-S. Now, I'm going to try. We had antiphonal singing, you know, like responsive singing. I'm going to try. This side is the abrupt appearance side, and this side is the stasis side. Stasis means stability, stuck in a rut, or you might say non-evolution. Okay? In other words, once animals appear, they don't vary. They don't get more complex. They don't go down. They don't go up. They just stay the same. It's kind of boring, some students have said at my college. Not to me, hopefully. But if something's boring, boring. You ever heard that? Okay, that's stasis. But in this case, it would be stasis. Okay. All right. So what I will do is this will be a fill in the blank. First, animals exhibit, and then you'll shout as loud as you can, abrupt appearance. All right? And then after that, they exhibit stasis. Well, okay, hold on. Okay, this group is excited. You got to really hit it hard. You ready? Okay, animals first exhibit abrupt appearance. Hey, there's some liveliness there. And I think you have quite as many people as over here, so I'll give you an additional 20 points because of the lack of people over here. And then this side, and then they exhibit stasis. Okay, I'll give you both an A+. How's that? All right, everybody wins. Okay, this is kind of a little crazy thing that I do sometimes to just, you know, liven it. Just if you learn these two things, I mean, I shared this with a lady in South St. Pete. She was in her early 80s. She was taking around the wife of the founder of our college, Mrs. Watson, age 92. She was the driver. She came to a banquet. We had a missions banquet, and I was sitting with her. And I had given this talk to the little old ladies at the Golden Circle of Trinity College, the college where I teach. And I had mentioned these, you know, and given some examples, held up some fossils and so forth. And she said, oh, I've used your material. I was sitting with her at dinner. She said, oh, I should tell you, Dr. Woodard, I've been using your material to witness to the atheist lady. She's in her 80s also. She's across the cul-de-sac from me in St. Pete. I said, what material? She says, oh, abrupt appearance and stasis. I said, you've been using that to witness? She says, yeah, I went over to this lady. I made an appointment. We had tea and her coffee in her house. And she said, then I told her all about the fossils, and I explained abrupt appearance, and I explained stasis, and then I shared Jesus. I said, I love it. And can I use you as an example? She said, sure. You know, so she attended a 10-minute talk, and she heard this stuff and then used it as a tool to build a bridge to the lady across the cul-de-sac. I think that's pretty cool. Okay, now, what we have here is a problem because evolution demands this kind of like gradual development from, let's say, invertebrates. Then we should have fishes. And then finally, we get up here where we have amphibians. So we should find kind of a continuation or continuum, right? Kind of a blending, and you just kind of gradually move, and you can barely draw a dotted line as you kind of phase from one to the other. Is that the way the fossil record has turned out? No. This is what they hope to find, but what they find is this. Invertebrates appear in the burst down in the Cambrian rocks. Then you have the fishes appear, you know, separately. And then you have amphibians appear. And then what happens over time? Whoops, where did that happen? I'm sorry, you don't get Darwin. How did Darwin get in there? Okay, then you get Darwin. That's the last, the height of evolution. That was weird. Thank you, Lord. Okay. But what you find, I thought that these little explosions would grow in size. I had a program thing that didn't work quite right. Okay. This is very hang loose tonight, okay? But the fishes and invertebrates and amphibians, the first four-footed land animals supposedly, appear separately as islands, discontinuous, in other words, not connected with anything else. Everybody got that? So they appear abruptly, and then they stay the same. Darwin's admitted a problem with transitional fossils in his book, Origin of Species. This is what he said. This the lack of transitions is probably the gravest and most obvious
of all the many objections which may be urged against my views. Now think about that. Darwin, at least, in many places in his book, was an honest man. He actually is kind of interesting to read. You know, he'll do an incredible job trying to get out of the most impossible situations with his theory. He's very, very clever. But he had to honestly admit that this fossil problem is a huge problem for my theory. A prime example is this Eocene bat. He's supposedly dated in, it was found in Wyoming, dated 50 million years ago. That's what MYA. I do not agree with those dates. I'm just giving them as supposed dates. And its structure was virtually identical to a modern brown bat. This is an example of abrupt appearance. You see sudden appearance. The first bat is like a modern bat, and after that, stasis. You see the point? They don't have transitions leading up to this early bat. Boom, there it is, abrupt appearance of modern bat form. And I mentioned this, Permian at top, Devonian and Cambrian at the bottom, and then pickle and cheese, all beef patty, and the special sauce in the middle. This is the Big Mac version of the fossil record. But I want to really point out that the excitement is down below. The excitement is down below in the Cambrian. You see the Cambrian level kind of down here, down at this level? And the Cambrian level is what we want to focus on. That is very, very important because at the Cambrian level, you have a sudden explosion of all the major categories of living things. Below the Cambrian, it's like a blank page. And it's just an amazing what they've found, because in the pre-Cambrian, you don't find much of anything, maybe one-celled animals. Okay, so the Cambrian explosion is where virtually all animal body plans appear suddenly, and then these date supposedly, again, from 540 million years ago. And then there's new shocking fossil evidence from Canada and China. Now, these are the classic. Before the Canada and China evidence came in, they had trilobites. Here's a trilobite with antlers, or antennae, I should say. Here's an ammonite, and here's a brittle star. Those are typical. I mean, Darwin knew about these Cambrian critters. He knew that the Cambrian explosion was rather significant. But then, in the 1910 to 1915 era, right before World War I, Charles Walcott went to this hillside in Canada, in the British-Canadian Rockies, called the Burgess Shale, and he pulled out literally trunks and footlockers of beautiful, precious Cambrian specimens, sent them back to the Smithsonian, and they gathered dust for 60 years. And finally, some scientists from Cambridge University came over, pulled out those drawers, blew off the dust, and what they found shocked them. Because they already knew that the Cambrian explosion was big, but they found whole new kinds of animals, like Wywaxia, an armored slug with seven to eight armored little, you know, like knives sticking out on each side. He's about 4 inches long. He is extinct. I'm very happy he's extinct. I would hate to have him snuggling up next to me to say hello at Clearwater Beach. Wywaxia, they had to create a whole new category when they found him in the drawers of the Smithsonian. Hallucigenia. A worm that walked on 7 pairs of tentacles, had 7 pairs of needles on its back. The hallucigenia worm was so weird that they thought they were literally hallucinating when they saw it. And then one said to the other, why don't we name it hallucigenia? That's literally how it got its name. These two animals, Wywaxia hallucigenia, appear suddenly. There's no transitions leading them. Boom, there they are. And then they stay the same until they go extinct. Let's talk about Opabinia. I showed him in one of my morning talks. Here's one artist conception. There's another, 5 eyes on its head, Piper Cub tail, swimmer oars on the side, and a long hose on the front end, a proboscis that looks like a fire hose with a grabber tip. I mentioned this morning an animal so ugly only its mother could love it, okay? Opabinia appears suddenly, abrupt appearance, and he stays the same. Life at Qingjiang includes we're going from Canada to China. This is the dig that is still ongoing and even bigger than Canada. Qingjiang is in South China near the Vietnam border. And the discoveries of Qingjiang have included Microdictyon in the middle. It's a worm with about 10 to 15 pairs of tentacles, and next to each pair of tentacles, it looks like 2 eye sockets pointing out to either direction. They're not sure if these were true eyes or sclerite eyes, which are fake eyes, but they look like real eyes, according to the paleontologist I spoke with. That appears suddenly. And then most famous of all, Anomalocaris attacks. This is the animal that has become world famous because he's a little bit different. He's like in a flying saucer with 2 eyes on stalks, 2 arms, grabber arms that look like jumbo shrimp. He has a tapered tail with swimming panels. He has got a round mouth underneath. You can't see on the belly of that flying saucer. It's a round mouth rimmed with teeth. And apparently it would grab prey, pull it, and hug it to the bottom, to the belly, and chomp away for its lunch. The other animals of the Cambrian explosion were 3 to 6 inches in length. This was 6 to 8 feet in length when fully grown. It was the king of the seas, and Anomalocaris there is considered the most fearsome, the most amazing, one of the most complex. Does it develop gradually? What do you guess? It bursts onto the scene suddenly, and after that it exhibits stasis. It stays the same. And again, I think we could use this as a weapon. But let me close this whole, you can turn off the slides. Let me close this whole evening together by telling the woman in about 1 minute or two the story of the lady who was in my wife's wedding and my wife and I were married in 1978. Excuse me, honey. I do remember our wedding, June 10th, okay? 1978. I have a quick recovery, okay? And the matron of honor was Mary Bergerson, a lady who is just a fabulous Christian in Sumter, South Carolina. And I was at a Wednesday night prayer meeting, and I had something like this. I forget, you know, it's a DNA or, you know, protein model. And we were coming back from the Dominican Republic. I'd just been hired to teach world missions at Trinity College. And Mary was just sitting there, and I didn't know she was taking notes. But I said, you know, scientists know that these are information-packed molecules. We call them informational macro, which means big, molecules. Informational macromolecules, DNA, RNA, and proteins. And I said, the science has discovered no process that can assemble these. Only intelligence appears capable of assembling these molecules. And so that's a real opening for sharing with people. Well, I didn't think anything of it, and so I went back to Trinity College, began my first year there. I think it was actually at the end of my first year, the beginning of my second. All of a sudden, I get a call from Mary, and she's excited. She's saying, I've got to tell you what happened. I went to the high school, Sumter High School, where John, their son, is going to pick him up for a doctor's appointment. And I was sitting there waiting for him, and these two students just out down the bench from me were razzing and making fun of creation. They were attacking creation based on what they'd heard in biology. And she said, I was sick. He said, I just wanted to say something. And then I realized, hey, I think I took notes of that Woodward talk. So she said, I dug in my purse and I found my notes and I reviewed them real quick. And I slid down where I could see those boys eye to eye. And I said, I told them, I couldn't help but overhear what you said. Have you heard about the informational macromolecules? And they said, what are those? She said, well, DNA, RNA, and proteins, all three of them are informational macromolecules. They're long informational molecules. That's what we call them, macromolecules. They're like a long spaghetti with these informational units, these letters stamped on them. And they said, wow, we've been studying that in biology. He said, sure. She said, it's really important. And what else they've discovered is that there's no process in nature ever discovered that can assemble these letters in the correct order. Only intelligence could do that. And the two students who had been mocking at creation, you know, said, really? We didn't know that. And she says, yeah, have you heard about the Romans Road, or I think it was four spiritual laws. Have you heard about the four spiritual laws? And they said, no. She said, can I share that with you? It tells you how you can know the Creator. And they said, sure. So she was sitting in Sumter High School sharing Christ with two students who had been mocking creation just a minute earlier. Now, she didn't have to have a PhD. She hadn't really ever attended a full seminar. She had attended a Wednesday night prayer meeting and had taken notes, and she put it to use. My prayer is that that might happen at Calvary Chapel. You are hereby commissioned as John and Mary Bergerson of the world, okay, or agents of change. And may you go and share the Lord with everybody you know using the tremendous information pouring out that points to our Creator. Thank you.